Picture a summer afternoon in Iowa, 1921. The corn is knee-high. A farmer is fixing fence out back when he hears something, a distant clatter, like a sewing machine crossed with a thundercloud. He looks up and there banking low over the tree line is a yellow biplane. It circles his pasture once, twice, and then it lands, just lands, right there in the hayfield he spent all spring worrying over. A young man in a leather jacket climbs down from the cockpit and walks over, casual as you please, and says, "Sir, if you let me use this field for the afternoon, I'll give you and your wife a free ride. You get me a place to park, I'll get you the sky." That handshake, that's barnstorming, that's the whole thing. I'm Tail Dragger on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because today we are talking about a chapter of aviation history that most people have heard of but very few actually understand. They know the word. They picture the biplane and the wing walker. But the real story of the barnstorming era runs deeper than the stunts. It started with a government trying to get rid of airplanes and ended with millions of Americans who had never once thought about flying suddenly believing the sky might be somewhere they could go. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now the year is 1918. November, the armistice has been signed and the Great War is over. The United States Army Air Service, which is what we called the Air Force before we called it the Air Force, finds itself sitting on something it does not quite know what to do with: airplanes. Thousands of them. During the war, the country had ramped up production at a pace that today would seem almost impossible. Factories that had been making furniture and farm equipment were cranking out aircraft. Training fields had sprouted from Texas to New York. They needed pilots, so they trained pilots. Thousands of young men learned to fly over fields in Georgia and Ohio and California, came home with leather jackets and a log full of hours, and found exactly zero civilian aviation jobs waiting for them. Because in 1918, civilian aviation barely existed. So in 1919, the government did what governments do when they have too much of something. They sold it. The War Assets Administration began unloading surplus military aircraft at prices that, even accounting for the times, were almost absurdly low. The most common airplane on the lot was a two-seat biplane built by the Curtiss Aeroplane and Motor Company of Hammondsport, New York. The full designation was JN-4D, but nobody in aviation called it that. Everybody called it the Jenny. During the war, Curtiss and its licensed manufacturers built approximately 6,300 Jennies, not as combat aircraft, as trainers. Most of them never left American soil. When the war ended, the military needed them gone and gone fast. Jennies were selling for $200, $300, maybe $500. A new Jenny had cost the government something close to $5,000 to build. Now they were going for a tenth of that. Think about what that meant in practical terms. For the first time in the history of the world, a private individual with a modest bank account could actually buy an airplane. Not a wealthy industrialist, not a government program. A veteran with his mustering out pay and a willingness to figure out the rest as he went. They bought them by the hundreds. Now, the Jenny. Let me tell you what she was, because she matters to this story. 44-foot wingspan, give or take, fabric-covered wood frame, powered by the Curtiss Ox 5 water-cooled V8 engine, 90 horsepower. She cruised somewhere around 75 miles an hour and topped out somewhere around 75 miles an hour, which tells you she didn't have a lot of margin between comfortable and flat out. That actually wasn't a problem for what she was about to be used for. What mattered more was her temperament. The Jenny was a forgiving airplane. She didn't snap into a spin the moment you mistreated her. She gave you time. She telegraphed trouble before it arrived. For a war-trained pilot operating low over a crowd of strangers with no safety net and no second chances, that forgiving nature was not a small thing. It was survival. The OX-5 engine, though, was another conversation entirely. That engine was, to put it politely, a personality. It ran hot. It leaked coolant in ways that kept you guessing. It had a deep and sincere affection for throwing rocker arms at exactly the wrong moments. The pilots who flew behind OX-5 engines developed a sixth sense for the subtle changes in sound that meant trouble was inbound. They also developed the habit, every single flight without exception, of identifying a usable field before they needed one. That habit, by the way, still applies. I'm just noting that for anyone listening who hasn't internalized it yet. The barnstormers came from everywhere, veterans who'd trained in the military and couldn't face the idea of giving up flying, farm boys who'd scraped together enough to buy a Jenny on credit and taught themselves through trial and hard landings, women who had discovered aviation before the war and refused to be grounded by peace. Their business model was beautifully simple. You find a farmer or landowner willing to let you use a pasture. You put up a few handmade signs in town. Sometimes you drove down Main Street in a borrowed car, horn going, and then you set up for business. $1.50 for a 15-minute ride, sometimes $2, sometimes 50 cents in a lean county during a dry summer. The crowds came, they always came, because in 1922 or 23, most rural Americans had never seen an airplane up close. Some had never seen one at all. They'd heard about the flying business. Read about the Wright brothers, maybe seen a blurry photograph, but here was one, right here, in the meadow outside of town. You could walk up and touch it, and you could go right now for $1.50. Think about what that first ride felt like. You climb up onto the lower wing, and the pilot helps you into the front cockpit. Open air, no canopy. A small curved windscreen in front of you that did roughly nothing against the slipstream. The wind hits you before the engine even starts. The cockpit smells like castor oil, because the OAX 5 used castor oil as a lubricant, and some of it always found its way into the air around you. Hot metal, fabric, dope, which is the lacquer they used to stiffen the linen that covered the wings and gave it that slightly sharp chemical edge. The engine fires up, not the polite whine of a modern airplane. The OAX 5 had a sound all its own, ragged and thumping and slightly irritated, like a very large mechanical animal that wasn't sure it wanted to cooperate today. Then you roll across the grass, tail up, and then the grass falls away and you're airborne. From 2,000 feet above an Indiana cornfield, the world looks completely different than it does from a wagon seat or a front porch. The farmer sees his own land for the first time from above. He can see the river winding through the bottomland. He can see the steeple of the church in town. He can see the road he drives every week, and suddenly understand from up here how it connects to everything around it. 15 minutes later, he lands, climbs out. Something has changed, something fundamental and permanent. Because now he knows, personally, in his bones, that human beings can fly. Not in theory, he just did it. That experience, multiplied by the hundreds of thousands of people who took rides between 1919 and the late 1920s, is the barnstorming era's real legacy. It created aviation's first mass audience. Now here's where it gets interesting. Because a simple ride was only the beginning. The barnstormers figured out quickly that spectacle drew bigger crowds and commanded bigger gates. And so the stunts began. Wing walking was the most visible act. A performer would climb out of the cockpit in flight, work along the wing using hand and foot holds installed specifically for the purpose, and stand upright on the top wing while the pilot flew the airplane. Some wing walkers went further. They hung by their knees from the landing gear. They did handstands 2,500 feet in the air. Ormer Locklear, a barnstormer out of Greenville, Texas, became the most famous wing walker of the era. He had learned the art as a military trainer, discovered he had a talent for it, and turned it into a career, then a movie career. Silent films that used real aerial stunts, not camera tricks or painted backdrops. Real airplanes, real altitude, real Ormer Locklear standing on the upper wing. He died in 1920, filming a night sequence for a picture called The Skywayman. Floodlights on the ground meant to illuminate the finale, disoriented him in the dark. He flew straight in. He was 28 years old, and then there were the parachutists. A jumper would climb out at altitude, hang from a wing strut or the landing gear, and fall. In the early days, the parachutes were not automatic. You pulled the ripcord yourself. The first several hundred feet of freefall were an act of faith and the expectation that your hand was going to find that handle where you remembered putting it. Charles Lindbergh did this. I want you to hold that thought for a moment. Before the Atlantic, before the Spirit of St. Louis, before Lucky Lindy was a name anyone outside of rural America had ever heard, Charles Lindbergh was a barnstormer working the Midwest and the South. He sold rides. He made parachute jumps for whatever the flying circus would pay. He bailed out of stricken airplanes multiple times over his barnstorming years, not as a stunt but as a survival measure, because the OAX 5 quit and the altitude ran out, and the field ahead was not long enough, and the parachute was the only option left. The barnstorming life was not the controlled daring of the performance. It was the uncontrolled reality of old engines, night flying without instruments, winter weather and open cockpits. Lindbergh survived it and went on to what history remembers him for. A lot of others didn't, because the barnstormers lived hard. They slept under their wings, ate when the gate was good, went without when the weather closed in or the engine threw something important. They flew into weather they had no business flying into because the next town on the circuit was 60 miles away and the bank account was lighter than it should have been. Winter touring was brutal. Open cockpit with no heat, temperatures well below freezing at altitude. Pilots wore layers on layers, newspaper under flying suits for insulation, and still arrived at destinations so cold they could barely get out of the cockpit. Their water-cooled engines could overheat in summer and freeze up in winter, and the Jenny was not built with the kind of redundancy that made you comfortable about either. If the engine quit on takeoff, your options were what was in front of you: fence or field, ditch or barn. You made the decision in the first 3 seconds, and you lived or you didn't. By the mid-20s, the federal government had started paying attention to what was happening in the skies above rural America. Attention of the concerned variety. The accident rate was not something you'd want to advertise. Barnstorming crashes were regular items in local newspapers. Some were fatal, some were spectacular enough to make the national wire. The image of aviation that the Barnstormers had spent a decade building, heroic, adventurous, accessible, was being complicated by the image of crumpled fabric and broken spruce in someone's alfalfa field. In 1926, Congress passed the Air Commerce Act, first serious attempt by the federal government to regulate civil aviation in the United States. Pilot licensing requirements, aircraft airworthiness certification, authority to investigate accidents for Barnstormers, this was complicated news. Some of the more safety-conscious pilots in the business actually welcomed it. They'd been watching the accident rate for years and knew the free-for-all couldn't last. Others resented the paperwork, the fees, the inspectors who arrived with checklists and sometimes left with grounding orders. The certification process cost money, and the Jenny by 1926 was genuinely getting old. They had been built as wartime training aircraft, not as long-term commercial workhorses. Many were on their third or fourth set of wings, held together by patches and skill and a particular brand of optimism that comes from not knowing when to stop. The Great Depression finished what regulation had started. When money got genuinely scarce, the $1.50 airplane ride became a luxury. The flying circuses packed up. The Barnstormers found other work, some in the young airline industry, some in the airmail service, some in the military, some back on the farm they'd left behind. But here's what I want you to take from this. In the decade between the end of World War I and the beginning of the Depression, the Barnstormers flew millions of Americans who would never have experienced flight any other way. They flew in rural counties that commercial airlines would not serve for another generation. They flew the farmers and the school teachers and the shop clerks and the kids who grew up to design the aircraft that won World War II. The Barnstorming era created American aviation culture. The sense that flying was something ordinary people could do, not a government project or a rich man's toy. The love affair between rural America and small airplanes. The love affair that shows up every July at Oshkosh, at Sun and Fun, at a thousand little fly-ins at a thousand little airports from Maine to Alaska. That love affair started in a hayfield. It started with a young veteran in a worn leather jacket, 90 horsepower of uncertain temper behind him, asking a stranger if he could land. When you go to an air show and watch a wing walker work the upper surface of a biplane, you are watching a direct descendant of that first Barnstorming summer. When you fly into a small strip and the owner walks out to chat and hands you a cold drink, because that is simply what you do at a small airport, you are living in a world those Barnstormers built. Not with regulations, not with infrastructure. With a Jenny, a few gallons of fuel, and the nerve to land somewhere nobody expected them. Much of what I've drawn on today comes from the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum's collections on early American aviation history, and from Charles Plank's research on the surplus aircraft era. You can find more at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger. The sky doesn't charge admission. Go fly.